from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
My name is Anthony Lagaranis, and I was an interrogator and Arabic linguist in Iraq during the year of 2004. And I interrogated at Abu Ghraib as well as other detention facilities all over Iraq. And I did see abuses. I myself committed abuses of detainees.
In his first live interview, former U.S. Army interrogator Tony Lagaranis tells his story. Then we'll speak with two Washington attorneys about the latest twists in torture legislation on Capitol Hill. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Newly released documents show Supreme Court Justice nominee Samuel Alito said 20 years ago, quote, "The Constitution does not protect a right to an abortion." Alito made the statements in a job application to become deputy assistant to Ronald Reagan's Attorney General Edwin Meese. In the job application, he wrote, "I'm particularly proud of my contributions in recent cases in which the government argued that racial and ethnic quotas should not be allowed, and that the Constitution does not protect a right to abortion." Alito said it had been a source, quote, "of great personal satisfaction to help advance such legal causes because he believed in them, quote, very strongly." He also wrote at the time, quote, "I believe very strongly in limited government, federalism, free enterprise, the supremacy of the elected branches of government, the need for a strong defense and effective law enforcement, and legitimacy of a government role in protecting traditional values." In the same document, Alito revealed he was a lifelong registered Republican, a Federalist Society member, and that he had donated money to the National Republican Congressional Committee and the National Conservative Political Action Committee. Senator Patrick Leahy, the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, said the documents reveal Alito is a, quote, "aggressive participant in an ideological movement intended to withdraw discrimination protections from workers." Alito's confirmation hearing is scheduled to begin on January 9th. On Capitol Hill, a bipartisan group of senators reached a compromise late Monday night on the rights of detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. Under the deal worked out by Republican Lindsey Graham and Democrat Carl Levin, detainees convicted by military tribunals can have their cases reviewed by federal courts. The agreement was reached 4 days after the Senate agreed to strip detainees of their right to challenge their detention in federal courts, overturning a June 2004 Supreme Court ruling that affirmed the right to habeas corpus. The compromise reached with Levin last night will also grant any detainee sentenced to death or at least 10 years of prison by a military trial an automatic appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. In addition, the deal restores federal court jurisdiction over pending cases and provides for a court review of whether standards and procedures of the tribunals are consistent with the Constitution. A new congressional investigation has concluded politics played a major role in last year's decision by federal drug regulators to ban the sale of the morning-after birth control pill. On Monday, the Governmental Accountability Office issued a report examining why the Food and Drug Administration rejected over-the-counter sales of Plan B. For years, conservative groups have opposed the sale of Plan B because some opponents of abortion consider the morning-after pill tantamount to ending a pregnancy. The GAO determined the FDA agreed to reject over-the-counter sales of Plan B months before a government scientific review of the application was completed. The GAO also found the FDA's decision to ignore the recommendation of an independent advisory committee, as well as the agency's own scientific review staff, was unprecedented. Democratic Senators Patty Murray and Hillary Rodham Clinton Monday said the GAO report, quote, "has confirmed what we've always suspected, that this was a politically motivated decision that came down from the highest levels at the FDA." The Spanish newspaper El País is reporting CIA planes made at least 10 secret stopovers inside the country while transporting detainees. The secret stops occurred at airports in Spain's Baleic Islands. Spain's opposition party, the United Left Party, has called on the country's interior minister to explain the use of Spanish airports for what it describes as the CIA's plane prisons. Another Spanish newspaper, Diario de Mallorca, reports that a CIA plane that took off from the Spanish island of Mallorca was involved in the alleged CIA kidnapping of a Lebanese-born German who says he was snatched up in Macedonia, then transported to Afghanistan. The man, who's since been released, claims in Afghanistan he was shackled, beaten, injected with drugs, and questioned persistently about his alleged links with Al-Qaeda. A number of probes are underway in Europe over covert CIA operations there. The Italian and German governments are both investigating allegations that the CIA has kidnapped individuals within their borders. Italy seeking the extradition of 22 CIA agents for the involvement in one such kidnapping. The Washington Post also recently reported the CIA has two secret prisons in Eastern European countries, but at the request of the Pentagon has refused to release where. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has announced Israel has agreed to allow Palestinians to reopen the border between the Gaza town of Rafah and Egypt. The Rafah terminal is the only land crossing between Gaza and the rest of the world that bypasses Israel. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, this will mark the first time Palestinians will have control over the border. In return, Israel is planning to set up video surveillance to allow it to monitor all movement along the crossing. The agreement came just a day after Middle East envoy James Wolfensohn warned Israel's border policies are turning Gaza into a, quote, giant prison. As part of the agreement, Israel will also permit the export of all Palestinian agricultural products from Gaza during the upcoming harvest. This is Condoleezza Rice.
It is very important for ordinary Palestinian people in their daily lives, whether it is the farmer or the university student or the restaurant owner, that there be freedom of movement established in between Gaza and the West Bank.
That was Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. In France, President Jacques Chirac admitted last night the recent youth uprising revealed a, quote, profound malaise in French society. Chirac vowed to fight the poison of racial discrimination. France has been rocked by 18 nights of rioting and civil disturbances led by young people of Arab and North African descent. Chirac also confirmed his government will seek to extend the right to invoke emergency laws until mid-February. Under the emergency laws, local governments are allowed to impose curfews, ban public meetings and gatherings. The laws were first put in place 50 years ago to quell the independence movement in Algeria. The controversial former Iraqi exile leader Ahmed Chalabi met with Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in Washington Monday. Before the Iraq invasion, Chalabi was a close ally of the U.S. neoconservatives and the Pentagon. The meetings took place even though the FBI is investigating Chalabi for passing U.S. secrets to Iran. Last week, Chalabi also met with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Venezuela and Mexico have decided to withdraw ambassadors from each other's countries. The move came after Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez accused his Mexican counterpart, Vicente Fox, of being a lapdog of the United States. Chavez criticized Mexico for backing the U.S. on the free trade area of the Americas. Human rights attorneys have announced plans to sue the U.S. and Brazilian governments for their alleged role in massacres in Haiti. The lawsuits are being filed today before the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights. The attorneys allege the U.S. has financially supported the Haitian security forces that have committed atrocities and that Brazilian UN peacekeeping troops have been involved in politically motivated killings. In Uganda, the country's leading opposition politician, Kizza Besigye, has been arrested. The government's charged him with treason and rape. Besigye has lived in exile in South Africa for 4 years, but returned to Uganda 3 weeks ago to run in the country's upcoming election. If found guilty, he could face the death penalty. Thousands of supporters of Besigye's filled the streets Monday in protest. Police responded by firing tear gas at the demonstrators. And the influential Native American writer, philosopher, scholar, and activist Vine Deloria Jr. has died at the age of 72. He wrote many books, including Custer Died for Your Sins, An Indian Manifesto, and God is Red. He was one of the most prolific and influential scholars of the 20th century on American Indian law and policy, history, and philosophy. He was also respected as an advocate for indigenous peoples' rights around the world. Vindaloria's political writings in the 60s sounded a rallying call for Native American sovereignty and self-determination at a time when the American Indian movement was emerging. Wilma Mankiller, the former principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, said of Deloria, quote, "He's been our ranking scholar and intellectual light for all of those years." And that's some of the news. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Two former Iraqi detainees say they were repeatedly tortured for months by U.S. forces seeking information about Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction. In an exclusive interview with ABC News, the two men, Thahi Sabar and Shirzad Khalid, said they were captured July 2003 in Iraq. They were held in various locations, including the infamous Abu Ghraib prison. They claim over a period of months, U.S. soldiers beat them severely with wooden sticks, deprived them of food, water, and sleep, and threatened them with mock execution, including using live lions and firing squads. In the interview, Saban says he was lined up with other prisoners and U.S. soldiers, quote, shot towards our heads and chests. And when the shot sounded, some of us lost consciousness. Some started to cry. Some lost control of their bladders and they were laughing the whole time, he said. The allegations are just the latest in a long list of allegations of abuse of prisoners by U.S. forces. The news comes as the Bush administration continues to lobby Congress for an amendment that would exempt the CIA from a ban on torture. The ban was approved last month in a measure put forward by Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona. Appearing on CBS's Face the Nation Sunday, McCain said, quote, "If we're viewed as a country that engages in torture, any possible information we might be able to gain is far counterbalanced by the negative effect of public opinion." Earlier this month, The Washington Post revealed the existence of a global network of secret facilities used by the CIA to interrogate prisoners. The facilities include an unidentified Soviet-era prison in Eastern Europe, prompting fears the Bush administration is using the secret detention facilities for interrogation practices illegal under federal and international law. A Democratic effort for a congressional inquiry was defeated in the Senate. President Bush was asked about these issues during a stop in Panama last week, and he said that the U.S. doesn't engage in torture. Despite Bush's disavowal of torture, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley indicated Sunday the White House has not ruled out its use. He appeared on CNN's Late Edition with Wolf Blitzer, and Hadley said, quote, "What happens if on September 7, 2001, we had gotten one of the hijackers and based on information associated with that arrest, believe that within 4 days there's going to be a devastating attack on the U.S.? It's a difficult dilemma to know what to do in that circumstance to both discharge our responsibility to protect the American people from terrorist attack and follow the president's guidance of staying within the confines of law." Those are the words of the National Security Advisor, Stephen Hadley. Well, last month, Democracy Now! Held an extensive interview with Janice Karpinski, the former general in charge of the Abu Ghraib prison. She described what she witnessed there.
General Miller said his first observation was that they were being too nice to them. They were not being aggressive enough. And he used the example at Guantanamo Bay that the prisoners there, when they're brought in, that they're handled by two military policemen, they're escorted everywhere they go, belly chains, leg irons, hand irons. And he said, you have to treat them like dogs.
General Janice Karpinski, the former commander of Abu Ghraib. She's been demoted to colonel. Well, today, in his first live interview, we will hear another voice from inside Abu Ghraib, former specialist Tony Lagaranis. He was a U.S. Army interrogator from 2001 to 2005, served a tour of duty in Iraq from January 2004 to January 2005. He was first stationed at Abu Ghraib. In spring of 2004, he joined a special intelligence gathering task force that moved among detention facilities around Iraq. He was in Iraq until January of this year, when he left with an honorable discharge. He joins us from a studio in Chicago. Tony, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you start by telling us how you joined the Army?
Yeah, I had a lot of student loans, so I was, you know, looking for a way to pay those off. I also was interested in learning Arabic, and I'd met a former Army interrogator who had learned Russian and German in the Army, and it just seemed like an attractive deal to me.
And so where did you first go? Where did you train?
Well, basic training was at Fort Benning, Georgia. Then I went to Fort Huachuca, which is where they do most of the intelligence training. That's where I learned to do interrogations and general human intelligence collecting. After that, I went to Monterey, to DLI, where they teach languages, and I learned Arabic there.
Did you join before or after the September 11th attacks?
I joined in May of 2001.
Right before.
Right.
Did things change after those attacks in terms of the climate when you were training?
No, not really. I mean, certainly I was in interrogation school at the time of the attacks, so the doctrine stayed the same. They didn't have time to change it. They also didn't know where we'd be fighting. You know, we really didn't have a clear picture of what the enemy would be at that time, so the doctrine just stayed the same.
So talk about going to Iraq when you went.
Okay. We flew to Kuwait first, and then we convoyed up from Kuwait to Abu Ghraib, which is just outside of Baghdad. We were in Humvees with no armor, but it was still relatively safe in Iraq at that time. The insurgency was just beginning. So I arrived at Abu Ghraib. And as soon as we arrived there, the events that caused the scandal had already happened in November of 2003. And I arrived there in January of 2004. So they told us that bad things had happened, that MPs had gotten in trouble for detainee abuse, and that everything was going to change. But no one was really allowed to talk about it. So we didn't know what had happened exactly.
So you knew, as you got there, that military police had abused prisoners.
Right. Yeah, that was the first briefing we got from the colonel at Abu Ghraib told us this. And, you know, there were interrogators who had been there during the time of the events of the scandal, but they weren't allowed to talk about it, and we really didn't ask them about it. So we didn't know what was going on.
And the month you arrived at Abu Ghraib?
It was January of 2004.
And who were you responsible to? Who was the general in charge? You were a military interrogator.
Honestly, I don't remember at that time who was in charge. I was only at Abu Ghraib for about a month and a half until I got sent off on a mobile team. So I don't know who it was.
Tell us what happened at Abu Ghraib.
Well, things had started to get a lot cleaner there. There was a lot more oversight, and that progressed even in the month that I was there, and also all my friends, my unit was working there the whole time, and they saw things progress. So Abu Ghraib became a pretty sterile interrogation facility by the time we left Iraq.
Did you interrogate prisoners at Abu Ghraib?
I did, yes.
Mm-hmm. And
I was on a team that was, we were the special projects team, and at that time we were working on people who were arrested with Saddam Hussein and arrests that surrounded that case.
And who did you interrogate? Do you remember their names?
Well, I can't say that.
And how did you interrogate them?
It was totally straightforward at Abu Ghraib. It was just talking. It was just like we were trained in the schoolhouse, right out of the Army Field Manual. We would just talk to them, ask them questions, maybe use some psychological approaches, but nothing too serious. But I knew that some interrogators there were still, at that time, in January 2004, using a little bit harsher techniques, like if a prisoner wasn't cooperating, they could adjust his diet. People were in deep isolation for months there, which I believe is illegal according to Army doctrine. And they would also take their clothes and their mattress so that they would be, you know, cold in their cells.
Naked.
If they weren't cooperating. I don't know if naked, but they would definitely take blankets and take extra clothes that they would need to stay warm.
I want to ask you about the use of dogs and also about General Miller, who came to Iraq. And according to General Karpinski, in charge of the military police, changed the tenor, changed the actions of the interrogators at Abu Ghraib. And I want to ask if that was the case for you as well. This is Democracy Now! We're talking to Tony Lagaranas, who is a former U.S. Army interrogator. He was at Abu Ghraib and other prison facilities in Iraq. We'll be back with him in a minute. Calvin Singh here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on close to 400 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica, NPR, Low Power FM, college and community radio stations, as well as public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, channel 375, and we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Tony Lagaranas. He is a former U.S. Army interrogator, was in Iraq from January 2004 to January 2005, worked as an interrogator at Abu Ghraib and other prison facilities around Iraq. This is his first live interview. Tony, can you talk about the use of dogs?
We were using dogs in the Mosul detention facility, which was at the Mosul airport. We would put the prisoner in a shipping container. We would keep him up all night with music and strobe lights, stress positions, and then we would bring in dogs. And the prisoner was blindfolded, so he didn't really understand what was going on, but we had the dog controlled. He was being held by a military police dog handler on a leash, and the dog was muzzled, so he couldn't hurt the prisoner. That was the only time I ever saw dogs used in Iraq.
Did the prisoner know that there was a muzzle on the dog?
No, because he was blindfolded. So the dog would be, you know, barking and jumping on the prisoner, and the prisoner wouldn't really understand what was going on.
What did you think of this practice that you were engaging in?
Well, I knew that we were really walking the line, and I was going through the interrogation rules of engagement that was given to me by the unit that we were working with up there, trying to figure out what was legal, what wasn't legal. And it, according to this interrogation rules of engagement, that was legal. So when they ordered me to do it, I had to do it. And, you know, as far as whether, you know, I thought it was a good interrogation practice, I didn't think so at all, actually. We never produced any intelligence.
At this point, when you got there, the photos were out. If not out to the public, they came out in April of 2004, certainly being circulated among soldiers. Had you seen pictures?
I only saw the pictures when they came out on the news. And in fact, I was up there using the dogs at the very time that the scandal broke. But I don't think those pictures were being circulated among soldiers. I mean, I certainly never saw them mm-hmm. before they came out on 60 Minutes.
And so when you saw them and you yourself were engaging in this practice, what were your thoughts?
I think my initial reaction was that these were bad apples, like, you know, the White House line. But, it's funny, like, I didn't even really tie it to what we were doing up there, you know. And we were using some pretty harsh methods on the prisoners, and I'd seen other units that were using really severe methods, but I didn't tie it to, you know, to the scandal. It just seemed like I don't know why. I don't know.
What do you mean by really harsh methods?
Well, we were an Army detention facility, and we would get prisoners from other units that were arresting people up there, for instance, the Navy SEALs. And when the Navy SEALs would interrogate people, they were using ice water to lower the body temperature of the prisoner, and they would take his rectal temperature in order to make sure that he didn't die. I didn't see this, but that's what many, many prisoners told me who came out of the SEAL compound. And I also heard that from a guard who was working in our detention facility who was present during an interrogation that the SEALs had done.
Where is the SEAL compound?
It was in the same place. It was at the Mosul airport, but I never actually went inside the compound myself.
Did you use hypothermia as a means of interrogating?
We did, yeah. We used hypothermia a lot. I mean, it was very cold up in Mosul at that time. And it was also raining a lot, so we would keep the prisoner outside, and they would have like a polyester jumpsuit on, and they would be wet and cold and freezing. But we weren't inducing hypothermia with ice water like the SEALs were. But, you know, maybe the SEALs were doing it better than we were because they were actually even controlling it with the thermometer, but we weren't even doing that.
At what point did you start to ask questions? Like when you say about the pictures that you didn't associate what you did with the scandal of the photographs that had come out. But when did you start to say, is this right?
Well, I always was. And it's funny, Amy, because I was sort of pushing to back away from the harsh tactics. But at the same time, I was... In a way, I sort of wanted to push because we were frustrated by, you know, not getting intel. I don't know why, but so I was on both sides of the fence. I don't know.
Were you having discussions with other interrogators?
Sure. We all talked about it. And I discussed this with my team leader all the time, the people I was working with all the time. Part of the problem back then, too, is that I was still under the impression that we were getting prisoners who had intel to give us. You know, I still thought that these were bad guys. I was believing the intelligence reports that came in with the prisoner. I believed the detaining units, but later it became clear to me that they were picking up just farmers. You know, like. These guys were totally innocent, and that's why we weren't getting intel. And it just made what we were doing like seem even more cruel.
You said that you engaged in abuse. Specifically, what did you feel was your most egregious abuses that you engaged in?
Well, you know, as I said, in Mosul, I was using... You know, dogs. I was using hypothermia. I was using sleep deprivation, isolation, dietary manipulation. That's all abuse according to the Army Field Manual, the Army Doctrine, and certainly according to the Geneva Conventions.
Did you understand the Geneva Conventions?
No, particularly because I didn't understand what classification the prisoners that we had were. Because, you know, you can get an EPW, enemy prisoner of war, you can get a, I don't know, security internee, you can get protected persons. They all have different classifications in the GEMA conventions, and they get different treatment by interrogators, and I didn't know what their classification was in Iraq. I was being told by my leaders that they, that these people were not enemy prisoners of war, and therefore, you know, the, we could really sort of do whatever we wanted, that, you know, but I don't know if that's even true. I don't know.
We're talking to Tony Lagaranis, a former U.S. Army interrogator in Iraq, at Mosul, in Abu Ghraib. Where else?
I was in North Babel at FOB Kalsu. I was also at Al Asad Air Force Base, which is in the western desert in the north. I was also in Fallujah during the last offensive.
You were in Fallujah.
Right.
What were you doing there?
My job in Fallujah was to go through the clothes and pockets of the dead bodies that we were picking up on the streets. And we would bring them back to a warehouse, and I'd go through their pockets and try and identify them and read whatever intel or anything that they had on them.
Because you spoke Arabic.
Right, right. That's why I was sent there.
How many dead bodies, corpses, did you go through?
500.
Can you talk about that experience?
Sure. I mean, you know, obviously it was terrible. You know, like these bodies had been laying out in the street in the sun for days, for sometimes 10 days before we picked them up. They'd been eaten by dogs and birds and maggots and... the Army thought that, or actually it wasn't the Army, it was Department of Defense, had sent all this electronic equipment for us to use to, like, take their retinal scans and take their fingerprints. But, I mean, it was just, it was impossible because these guys, they didn't have eyes anymore. They didn't have fingerprints anymore, you know. And then we couldn't bury the prisoners either because they hadn't really figured out how they were going to do that. So they were just stacking up in this warehouse in Fallujah, and that, you know, that's where we were living and sleeping and eating with all these dead bodies.
What do you mean they didn't have eyes? They didn't have fingerprints? They were burned?
Well, certainly some of them were burned. I mean, some of them didn't have arms anymore or whatever. But, I mean, they were just so rotten that their eyes were gone. They were, you know, they were just sockets with maggots.
We did a piece recently on the use of white phosphorus. Whiskey Pete, I think it's referred to in the military. There was an Italian documentary that just came out talking about the use of this, not to light up the sky, but to burn, to incinerate the victims in Fallujah at the time that you were there. Did you see use of this?
No, well, not that I know of. I don't know. I mean, I only heard about that recently, probably from your report. But no, I don't know anything about that.
You slept with the bodies, meaning they were at the. You had to sleep in this warehouse.
Right. Yeah.
Can you talk about that? And who you understood the people who were dead to be?
Well. A lot of them were certainly insurgents. You know, a lot of them had weapons. They had hand grenades. They had ammo vests. But a lot of them weren't either. I mean, we had women and children, old men, young boys. You know, it's hard to say. I think initially the reason that we were doing this was they were trying to find foreign fighters, and they were trying to prove that there were a lot of foreign fighters in Fallujah. So mainly that's what we were going for. But most of them really didn't have IDs, but maybe about half of them had IDs. Very few of them had foreign IDs. And there were people working with me who would, in an effort to sort of cook the books, you know, they would find a Quran on the guy, and the Quran was printed in Algeria, and they'd like mark him down as an Algerian, or you know, guys would come in with a black shirt and khaki pants, and they'd say, "Well, this is the Hezbollah uniform," and so they'd mark him down as a Lebanese, which was ridiculous. But you know.
So what did you say?
Well, I was only a specialist, so actually, you know, I did say something to you know, the staff sergeant who was really in charge, and you know, I just got yelled down, you know, shot down.
What do you mean shot down?
Well, he just told me, you know, he just put me in my place. He said, you know, this isn't for you to decide. I'm saying he's Lebanese, that's it.
What about the women and kids?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I would get a kid, like, burnt to a crisp. Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know what to say. We had women and children.
Did you have discussions about that?
Not really, no. I mean, we just sort of, like, noted it. Oh, too bad, you know, a kid died. Too bad we got a woman, but... we didn't really talk about that.
How many people would you estimate died in Fallujah?
I have no idea. I don't know. I remember hearing a number 10,000 out there from the Marines, but I don't know if that's accurate.
And could you estimate how many of them were what the U.S. military calls insurgents?
Well, I think we probably got, you know, we got a small number. We got 500 bodies. And from that sample, I'd say about 20% of them actually had weapons on them. But so who knows? I don't know. I think most people left Fallujah, who weren't going to stay there and fight, but I really don't know. I can't really say.
Did you ever deal with ghost detainees, this whole issue of people who were brought in who were not on the books so that the Red Cross wouldn't know about them to ask about them?
Sure. Yeah, that happened pretty often. In a way, that was a good thing because sometimes they wanted to just, like, bring somebody in and just get a little bit of information out of him and then release him, which would have been difficult if they'd actually registered him in the prison, because then he would be caught up in the bureaucracy and he might be there for weeks. So in a way, the ghosting was a good thing, but sometimes it wasn't. Like, you know, the SEALs or the FBI would put somebody in the prison and there were no records of, you know, physical damage had been done to him, just nothing. There were no records of it. So it probably made abuse, you know, a lot more easy to do.
Were you able to get intelligence out of your sessions with these men?
Sometimes. Pretty rarely, honestly. Like, I did more than 300 interrogations in Iraq, and I'm guessing like 20 people I got any like real intel out of. And when I did, it was when I would sort of form a rapport with the person and get him to trust me. Nothing ever came out of the harsh interrogation sessions.
We're talking to Tony Lagaranis, former U.S. Army interrogator. Time magazine this week is reporting that CIA interrogators apparently tried to cover up the death of an Iraqi ghost detainee who died while being interrogated at Abu Ghraib. Autopsy reports showed the detainee, his name is Manadel al-Jamadi, died of blunt force injuries and asphyxiation, believed to have suffocated after an empty sandbag was placed over his head while his arms were secured up and behind his back in a crucifixion-like pose. To cover up the killing, blood was mopped up with a chlorine solution before the interrogation scene could be examined by an investigator. A blood-stained hood that had covered his head also disappeared. Although the CIA ruled the killing a homicide, the CIA interrogator involved in his death remains free and continues to work at the agency. Jamadi was being held in a secret part of the Abu Ghraib prison that's off limits to international observers, including the Red Cross. Concerns been growing, as you know, about the whole issue of secret CIA prisons and even places within known prisons that are sort of off the books. Do you know about this man, Jamadi?
No. I never heard about that case at all.
Does this story sound familiar in other cases that you know or were involved with?
Yeah. North Babel was probably the place where I saw the worst evidence of abuse. This was in from August to October of 2004, so it was well after the Abu Ghraib scandal, and we were no longer using any harsh tactics within the prison. But I was working with a Marine unit, and they would go out and do a raid and stay in the detainees' homes and torture them there, and they were far worse than anything I ever saw in a prison. They were breaking bones. They were smashing people's feet with the back of an axe head. They burned people. They were doing some pretty harsh stuff.
Who is they?
This particularly was Force Recon. I don't know if they were subordinate to the 24th MU. 24th MU was running the detention facility there and running the FOB CALSU. And Force Recon was stationed there, but I don't know who they were subordinate to.
Can you, for people who are not familiar with the military, what are these words short for? What's Force Recon?
Oh, FOB? Oh, Force Recon is, like, they're reconnaissance. So their job is to, like, you know, go out and you know, spy on people, basically. But they're not really intel. They're much more like a special forces unit.
Mm-hmm. And FOB?
FOB is Forward Operating Base. So it's Forward Operating Base CALSU that I was at.
And that is where exactly?
It's in North Babel, south of Baghdad.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to go to break and then come back to you. We're talking about Tony Lagaranis, U.S. Army interrogator from 2001 to 2005 in Iraq for a year at Abu Ghraib, at al-Assad, at Mosul, at North Babel. We'll talk more in just a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest for the hour is Tony Lagaranis. He is a former U.S. Army interrogator, was in Iraq for a year, a military interrogator who traveled from prison to prison. If you could once again repeat what it is you saw there in Babel, who were the forces involved and what they were doing?
Well, I was... I was interrogating at the detention facility at Forward Operating Base CALSU, and I was getting prisoners that were arrested by Force Recon Marines. And they, every time Force Recon went on a raid, they would bring back prisoners who were bruised, with broken bones, sometimes with burns. They were pretty brutal to these guys. And I would ask the prisoners what happened, you know, how they received these wounds. And they would tell me that it was after their capture, while they were subdued, while they were handcuffed, and they were being questioned by the Force Recon Marines.
And what did they say happened to them?
They were being punched, kicked, you know, hit with, as I said, the back of an axe head. One guy was forced to sit on an exhaust pipe of a Humvee. And I would check out that story with other people that they had been arrested with, and they were consistent. So, I tended to believe what they were telling me.
What do you mean one was forced to sit on the exhaust pipe in the back of a Humvee? So what would happen to him?
Well, he had a giant blister, a third-degree burn on the back of his leg.
Because it was so hot.
Right.
And then at this point, you're supposed to question them.
Right. So, yeah, I was supposed to interrogate these guys, yeah.
And how do you go about doing that as they're in front of you with broken bones, beaten, smashed, punched, burned?
Well, as you know, as I said, this was really late in the year, and I'd really sort of given up using any harsh tactics. So I was trying to get these guys to trust me, telling them I'm going to help them out, which I really couldn't. I couldn't help anybody out at that place because everyone they arrested, innocent or guilty, no matter what I said, they just sent them to Abu Ghraib anyway. But
what do you mean?
Well, you know, the interrogator is, I'm the only person who's going to talk to this guy. It's not, there's no officer who's going to talk to him. The person who decides whether to let them go or to keep them is not going to interrogate them. So my recommendation should count for something, you know, but it didn't at FOB CALSU with the 24th MU Marines. Basically, everybody who came into that prison, they just determined that they were a terrorist, they were guilty, and they would send him to Abu Ghraib.
And what did you determine?
So, that, you know, like 98% of these guys hadn't done anything. I mean, they were picking up people for the stupidest things. Like, there's one guy they picked up. They stopped him at a checkpoint, you know, just a routine stop. He had a shovel in his trunk, and he had a cell phone in his pocket. And they said, well, you can use the shovel to bury an IED. You can use the cell phone to detonate it. He didn't have any explosives in his car. He had no weapons, nothing. They had no reason to believe that he was setting IEDs other than the shovel and the cell phone. And so, you know, that was the kind of prisoner they were bringing us.
Did you ever call for a stop to this or ask to speak to a higher up, Tony Lopez?
Oh, I did. I did all the time. You know, at that point, I was, like, so pissed at the military for what they were doing, you know. And, you know, I was yelling at the chief warrant officer, Marine, who was in charge of the detention facility. I was making an issue about it to the major of the Marines and the lieutenant colonel, who was the JAG guy, who was in charge of releasing or keeping the prisoners. I mean, but they just wouldn't listen, you know. They wanted numbers. They wanted numbers of terrorists apprehended at FOB CALSU, you know, so that they could brief that to the general.
Who is and the general?
I don't know. Who knows? But, you know, they were trying to impress somebody. So they wanted to say that we arrested this many terrorists. And when I would say they were innocent in my interrogation reports, they'd send the prisoner up to Abu Ghraib without my interrogation report. They just sent him up with no paperwork.
Who was in charge? Who was in charge there? Who was your immediate superior?
Well, my immediate superior was an army my team leader, an army sergeant. The guy in charge of the detention facility, intelligence operations, was Chief Warrant Officer Kern. He was a Marine.
And he was holding back your interrogation reports.
whether it was him or somebody higher up, I don't know. But I know that that he was the guy that we were submitting the interrogation reports to. I was also submitting abuse reports at FOB Kalsu, and I really suspected that those didn't really get investigated.
What do you mean by abuse reports?
Well, when anytime I see abuse or a prisoner tells me about abuse, I'm supposed to write a report about it so that it can be investigated and, you know, see who abused them, whatever. And I would send that up through the chain of command. But I don't think that they were doing anything with these abuse reports. And in the Army, when you send this up, it should go to CID, which is Criminal Investigations Division. I don't know what the D stands for, Division, Department. And I talked to those guys about five times in Iraq. And I talked to them again when I came back to Fort Gordon, Georgia. And after I did an interview with Frontline and told Frontline some of the same things I just told you, CID called me up and said, we ran your name through the system and we don't have any reports from you. Why didn't you report this stuff? So, like, I don't know what's happening to these abuse reports, but I don't think they're getting investigated. His name was Special Agent Kerr from CID.
From here in the United States.
Right. But he was in Iraq while I was there. And actually, I had filed one abuse report about the Navy SEALs that I told you about up in Mosul with this guy's roommate in Iraq while that guy was there. And he still had no idea, you know, that I had ever filed a report.
So what did you tell him?
I told him, you know, why, you know, well, I mean, I told him everything that I had reported on before, which is ridiculous because I've filed, you know, multiple reports about these things before.
About how many, roughly?
I don't know how many I filed at CalSU. I think it was three, but I know for sure two.
And Abu Ghraib?
Abu Ghraib, I filed two reports, and in
Mosul?
In Mosul, I don't remember. I actually don't think I actually filed a report in Mosul. I filed it when I came back to Abu Ghraib. So that was sort of included in one of the reports I filed in Abu Ghraib.
So now that they tell you that they don't have any of your reports on abuse, have you refiled?
Yes. Yeah. When Special Agent Kerr called me up after the Frontline interview, he came out to Chicago and we had like a 6-hour interview in my house and I refiled all these sworn statements.
Are they being investigated now?
I don't know. I mean, it's they wouldn't really tell me about that. I don't know. My guess is no, since they didn't do it before.
There's a term in the military, but also in civilian society, Tony, called moral courage. Can you talk about what that means to you?
Well, I don't know if I'm really the right person to talk about that, Amy. I don't know. I sort of feel like, you know, I didn't really have enough of it over there, you know. Don't know.
What, when you look back now, do you wish you had done?
Well, you know, we were trained to do interrogations according to the Geneva Conventions with enemy prisoners of war. And we trained using role players, using a conventional army prisoners, and also a terrorist organization, and we treated both of them as though they were enemy prisoners of war, and we weren't allowed to cross any lines. And so I don't know why I allowed the Army to order me to go against my training and against my better judgment and against my own moral judgment. But I did, and I should have just said no.
Do you feel like there's something you can do now?
I guess talking about it on television is one thing. I don't know.
Would you say when you see the court-martial of a few low-level soldiers, would you say that will start to stop the abuse, or how high up do you feel it goes?
Well, it obviously goes right up to the Pentagon because they were issuing the interrogation rules of engagement, and the interrogation rules of engagement are not in accordance with the Army Field Manual. They're not in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. So it's all the way up. you know, obviously Lindsey England and, you know, Grainer, you know, these guys, they, you know, they needed to be punished, but it's not just them. It should have gone all the way up the chain.
Did you see Donald Rumsfeld in Iraq? He went to al-Assad. He went to Abu Ghraib. In fact, when we had former General Karpinski in our studio, now demoted, who was in charge of military police at Abu Ghraib, she said she took him on a tour, and he went to the Saddam Hussein torture cells, and then she was taking him beyond, but he didn't want to go beyond. He just left after that photo op. Did you see him?
Right. I didn't. Actually, I was convoying back from Mosul when he was flying in. I would have gone to see him, but I didn't get a chance.
Vice President Dick Cheney is trying to get an exemption for CIA officers to be allowed to torture. What do you have to say to Vice President Cheney?
I think that using torture is the worst possible thing we could do. You know, you can't win a war against terrorism with bombs and force. It doesn't work. You have to win hearts and minds, and we're really failing. You know, using torture is absolutely the wrong way to go. And we're not getting any intel out of it either. Like, how many people did we get intel out of in Guantanamo? You know, a small handful. And in Abu Ghraib also, I didn't work there for that long, but many of my friends did. They worked there for all of 2004, and they told me they got nothing. They got no intel out of that place.
Sexual abuse?
Well, I can't even understand, like, how anybody thinks that that's a good interrogation procedure. Like, what? Who is going to talk to you if you're going to, like, sexually abuse somebody? That doesn't make any sense.
What about giving false so-called intelligence just to stop the abuse?
Sure, yeah. I'm sure that happens too.
Did you witness sexual abuse?
No. No. We never participated in anything like that.
Are you concerned about being retaliated against for speaking out?
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, that when CID called me, when Special Agent Kerr called me after the frontline interview, that was my first thought, was that the Army is going to try and prosecute me. I'm a little bit more worried about, you know, some, you know, just like a Navy SEAL or some Marine is going to decide he hates me because I'm talking about this stuff and come to my house. But, well, like, I've been getting, like, hate emails. My mom has received hate phone calls, you know. So.
And yet you're speaking out.
Sure, yeah.
Because?
Well, I feel like that's what my duty is right now, and I sort of want to correct some wrongs that I might have done.
And to someone who's in Iraq right now, what would you say to them, and what would you say to Iraqis?
Well, I'd like to apologize to Iraq, honestly, because I think we've done so many things wrong over there. I think the military guys wanted to go over there and really liberate Iraq, and we've just really screwed it up. So, yeah, it's terrible. But to the military guys in Iraq, I'd say, you know, follow your conscience, and don't do what everybody else is doing just because it seems like, you know, that's the right thing to do. It's not.
Tony Lagaranis, I want to thank you very much for being with us, former U.S. Army interrogator in Iraq for a year. Thanks for speaking out.
Thank you, Amy.
That does it for today's broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org. The transcript will be here of this interview, as well as the video and the audio. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Bergstrup of Okadoos, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Maddie Harper, Yoruba Rich, and Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.